Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good morning, good evening, good night, NBN Entrepreneurship and Leadership.
Personally, I'm fascinated by the story.
Trust is an underrated weapon in the business landscape.
I'm a really, really strong believer in learning by doing.
What's the definition of success?
You're trying to come up with an answer to the question. But go ahead, Richard.
You could be right, but you're wrong.
Good morning, good evening, good night, Entrepreneurship and Leadership Channel listeners on the New Books Network. I'm here with my friend and business partner, Kimon Fontakidis, and our special guest, Cormac Russell, who I would describe as a thought leader and community or social entrepreneur. But I think, I don't know Cormac very well, although we met on one or two online events. So Cormac, why don't you introduce yourself the way you normally would if you met a stranger at a social event or some kind of conference or something like that?
Well, thanks, Richard. Great to be with you. It's funny because normally I find myself being a bit hesitant about explaining what I do. I find myself in a lot of contexts where people aren't quite sure of what I do. But let me say that as I understand what I do, a lot of it is about getting alongside institutions and communities that want to work in a more effective way. So a lot of the challenges or the problems that I think I'm trying to address is a problem with the relationship between particularly communities of place and a various institution. So it could be a for-profit, it could be a not-for-profit, it could be a state-based institution. Like, for example, we've worked with hospitals in Singapore so that they could think differently about health. We've worked with folks in Wales, so the prison service there, particularly interested in our work, because they're struggling to figure out how they can release prisoners back into the community in a way that they stay there and they flourish. So they're just two examples, but we have lots of words. And I'm often really struck at parties, particularly when I try to explain what I do. I get blank expressions back at me, particularly with people who just don't have a working experience of community. So there may be questions that I need to answer better in that regard.
Okay, well, not to worry. The reason I came across you is because of a project I'm involved in called Village in the City, which is about community building. And I, as I understand it, you're either associated with or perhaps the inventor of the concept of asset-based community development. Now, perhaps before we go into your thoughts on that and explain what that is, could you explain, you know, why you've focused or devoted a lot of your life to the subject of community, why you think it's important, and then perhaps having said, because a lot of our listeners haven't really, I'm really interested about leadership in community contexts or what, you know, the role of entrepreneurship in a community context, like who are the people who make a community come to life or steer it. But I think to give a bit of a wider context, most of our listeners perhaps haven't thought about this very much. So imagine you're talking to intelligent people who haven't thought much about the role of a community up till now.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of how we think about anything, including making money, tends to be in line with market economics, which tend to be you find a problem, you develop a service, you make a profit out of doing that, hopefully, and life moves on. So much of the narrative is very much the Frank Sinatra song of I Did It My Way. And we've seen, you know, that kind of play out at large in some countries around the world. I think the reason that I'm interested in community is because it offers what I think is an enhanced and much richer story, actually as much from an entrepreneurial perspective as from, you know, a social justice perspective. So when I think of problems where I think of the neighborhood as the primary unit of change, as a distinct from a particular siloed issue, it opens up all kinds of possibilities that I couldn't see otherwise. And an example might be thinking at the moment, for example, if you're being entrepreneurial, about the various poly crises that we're dealing with. Energy was a good one, you know. So energy, which has become quite monopolized, 90% of the energy we consume to, you know, fuel our cars, light our factories, light our homes, is coming from quite distant, non-renewable, centralized monopolies. I think that's a great opportunity to actually think about what would be some local, small enterprises that create an alternative form of energy. So I think of places like the Isle of Egg off the Scottish coast, where they generate their own energy and they generate enough of that to actually reinvest in local entrepreneurial ideas of young people who they're now getting to come back to the island. So to me, that's a community mindset. The reason that they were able to see those opportunities was because they had a different entrepreneurial lens rather than the narrow lens that says, what's the problem? What's the niche? How do I fix it with a service? I think they're using the island or the community as the unit of change. And mm-hmm. that explains.
How does it, I guess you're going to, maybe that's what you're about to say. What do you do? Like what role, how do you actually make that happen? So you have obviously communities that have this power, actually, that have stuff that they mm-hmm. can do. And then you have these needs that can be met. How do you get leader? Yeah. Is it leadership? Is it like, I'm not sure exactly what you do and you can talk about that, but then is it identifying leaders within the community because obviously you need people to run it and to lead it and to make it happen.
Yeah. So first of all, the issue that we're dealing with here is disconnection. Right. So it's kind of like, you know, you've got all the apps, but no smartphone. That's the problem. And what I do first and foremost is I identify the problem in a different way to how a lot of people would identify the problem. So the problem isn't how do we reduce the number of people that are coming to ER. And how do we reduce the wait time? The problem is, how do we get further upstream? So social and political issues, which are causing health-related problems, are dealt with further upstream. So somebody who might say, hey, we think Cormac Russell could be useful here, may work in a hospital. So we're having conversations with Alberta Health, for example, who want to understand why they're spending 50% of their GDP in the province hospitalizing people and over the age of 65, particularly among lonely women. Quite a lot of people are spending time in hospital, not because they're sick, but because there isn't a community alternative. I'm the guy, I think, that in the first instance comes in and helps people just get a different perspective on the problem. So in a sense, you could say that's kind of standard consultancy as a service. But in terms of then how we might do something about that. So once you say, well, look, upstream, there are a set of opportunities or possibilities to create a new alternative, to create a community alternative. Well, that's fine. But how do you actually then animate those? And that's another piece that I am quite good at. So I'm able to actually say to an institutional leader, instead of reforming your system and trying to suck salvation from your own thumb, how about you take some resource and actually invest in these neighborhoods? So we say, like, for example, to Milwaukee Police Department, instead of trying to deal with crime and, you know, arrest the bad guys, why don't you ask the question, how come it's the same 15 neighborhoods that are producing the alumni of the city's prison? And what would happen if we took some resource away from enforcement And we pushed it further upstream to employ community builders in these neighborhoods to begin to start reweaving the social fabric that is ripped apart, which is actually the root cause of the Bloomin' problem in the first place, right? And then begin to discover, connect, and mobilize. You mentioned needs. I would say I'd start with the assets, actually. So what are the assets, competencies, capacities that are lying fallow in these places, that are disconnected? And how might we actually begin to do something about that? Start connecting those and mobilizing. And I would tend not to look for leaders as a starting point, because leaders really struggle to get themselves out of the way and actually invite others into conversation. I'd be more interested in finding connectors and conveners, people who are really good at the relationship building piece and the connection piece. I don't want to diss leaders. I think they're important when it comes to growing a followership around getting things done. We need them. But the problem I'm trying to fix is not a leadership problem. It's a connectorship problem. And I think if we can do that, it's much easier for leaders to lead. Sometimes, though, that's actually about leaders getting out of the way and being better hosts and being, you know, prepared to fail at being a hero. So, you know, in practice, in neighborhoods, we know that if you go into any neighborhood or village or favela, or, you know, I don't want to just narrowly define an urban context, but any small bounded local community which has its own economy, its multiplicity of cultures, its high street, etc., there are all kinds of possibilities that are currently invisible to most people. So I think a third thing that I do is I offer people a set of glasses at the local level, local businesses, local residents, local associations, to think a little bit differently about what might happen if we kind of take an ecological lens rather than just an elemental or siloed approach to things.
I think this is really fascinating and inspiring, actually. I think we should all be aspiring to do good. And I also do believe in the, you know, quality at source, finding the problem at the beginning rather than always treating the symptoms of the problem. Can you talk a little bit, though? Let's go back to the Milwaukee 15 neighborhood, 15 neighborhood that generates the majority of the criminals problem, and the idea of the connectors. How does it actually work? Somebody has to identify these connectors, and then what actually happens?
Well, it wouldn't be me. I mean, I'd be very cautious about, I'm calling in from Dublin, Ireland, parachuting in anywhere. I work in 36 countries around the world.
Right.
So the first thing, and it's a big deal, actually, when an institutional person figures out that the challenge here is to think like a social movement and behave like an entrepreneur, because most of the people who are leaders in our public sectors and in our charities don't, quite frankly. They kind of operate on the basis that we have a core mission, we need to get a client base, and we need to provide services. So once you get past all of that to your question, and we're to a point of let's use community building as a potential solution, our experience is that actually there are quite a lot of people at the neighborhood level who are already behaving like connectors. So there's indigenous competency, but they're just invisible. Like, we don't look for them because we're looking for leaders. So, you know, the average municipality that would go into one of these neighborhoods or police, they're either talking to people who caused the problem, have the problem, believe that the institution should fix the problem. They're not talking to people who in all kinds of ways are themselves health producers. They're kind of, those people are below their radars. So I'll give you an example, if I may, because I think this could give some context and make it a little bit concrete for folks. I remember a number of years ago in a neighborhood in Birmingham in the UK. So the neighborhood is Hodge Hill in Birmingham. It's about 20 kilometers outside of the city, heading towards the airport for anybody who knows Birmingham. And it's a population of about 5,000 people. So classically built at a time when, you know, cities were kind of clearing the center and kind of moving out towards the outer rings of the city. Often these neighborhoods were not properly resourced, so there weren't, you know, transport was poor, so there was very little thought that went into them. It was just, it was housing, and they were slapped out there. And over the course of, you know, 30, 40 years, that neighborhood had become a very, very complex, problematic neighborhood in terms of economy. And about 7 years ago, in the national newspapers, the neighborhood was described as the seventh most work-shy neighborhood in Britain. And local people living there, including local business people, got really angry, actually, and really annoyed at why the media was reporting on their wounds rather than on their possibilities, and creating a reputational deficit in that neighborhood, which made life, which was already hard, even harder. But what they started to do, to your question, was they started to say, well, how might we take this as an organizing issue rather than, you know, a programmatic issue? And about seven of them in the local context, seven local people said, well, what would happen if we gave this community a good listening to? And we went into all the bumping spaces and the gathering spaces in this neighborhood where people walk their dogs, where, you know, the 10 parents who stop for a chat after they drop the kids out after school, etc., really connect with people and find out what people love about this neighborhood, what people like about this neighborhood, what possibilities people see in this neighborhood, what's already happening that's good. But also, who do they know in the neighborhood that is connecting people, that's doing it already? And through that process, those seven people, they did this for about 12 weeks. They were all gregarious people anyway, so it wasn't taxing for them. They were just basically...
Sorry, and these people were from the neighborhood?
They're local residents.
Okay.
Local residents, yeah. So there was a Church of England minister, two or three of the members of his church. I don't want anybody to hear this and think it's only about faith, because it's not. Right. There were two local business people, and there was somebody who was a member of a book reading club and a history society and some local dog walkers, all of whom said, let's get together and do this, thought it was a good idea. So they started a listening campaign rather than let's end food poverty campaign, or let's, you know, go on a march campaign, or whatever else we do when it comes to campaigns. They decided to have a listening campaign. They discovered 93 people who fit the characteristics that I'm describing as a connector, who are gift-centered, who are relational, who are quite happy to get people connected and then get out of their way. They don't need to colonize that relationship or own it or get a return for it. It's not transactional. And what they did was they went to those 93 people, and first of all, they just thanked them. Said, look, actually, people are saying really good things about you, and they're appreciative. But also then they invited them to a party and asked them if they would bring four people from their block to that party. So they went from seven people to 500 people. And at a conversation at that party, they started asking people what else might be possible. What would a preferred future look like? And what assets do they currently have in the community? And then what assets would need to be leveraged externally? So I think my role essentially was to give a little bit of pedagogy, a little bit of scaffolding around how you might do that. So I offered some training. I work with a methodology that Richard's mentioned called asset-based community development. We're in our 30th year, so it's our anniversary this year. And that methodology basically says start close in and start with what's strong, not with what's wrong, and use those strengths to address what's wrong, but also to exploit possibilities, exploit opportunities to be entrepreneurial. 7 years on from that party of 500 people, and it has been a game changer. So thousands of people who weren't connected and weren't, you know, living their lives in crescendo, to use that term, are really moving into a very, very different space, and a very different set of relationships around their economy, around social care, around health, and around policing. So it really is about relocating authority back into democratic space at the neighborhood level.
And you're providing resources like money, and I mean, is there being so? Once you've said,
so
like,
what happened over time is, I mean, first of all, that was done on a voluntary basis, if you like. So people said, right, there's work to be done here, and if we don't do it, it won't get done. So there isn't an agency that sends seven people in to listen to your neighbors, right? So they kind of went, well, that sounds like community work. And by the way, that's no small point. Because I think if we were to say to most people listening, from an entrepreneurial perspective, what function do you think neighborhoods perform? I think a lot of your listeners would struggle to answer that question. In fact, I think a lot of people would struggle to answer that question. I know for certain most policymakers would really struggle. So the minister for, you know, enterprise and economy, I don't even think that's on their radar. I think one of the things that we do in our training is we put neighborhood on the map of policymakers and of decision makers, as well as local people. Over time, because I guess there was a kind of a stir, if you like. So this party that I described really opened up a lot of curiosity. So over time, the big lottery, which is a national lottery, the people buy the lottery the weekends or whatever, they've got a charity, so that redirects some of the money back into neighborhoods. So the neighborhood applied to employ a community builder that would work in a dedicated way using asset-based community development to keep the process going. So they kind of moved into a little bit more of an intentional, organized system, because they saw the potential and recognized that if they were going to do this, kind of proliferate this across the neighborhood in a way that would endure, they needed some additional resource. So another thing I do is I train those people. I train community builders. I'm not on my own. There's a whole network of people like me around the world, but I'm one of them. And in the UK, it's just one place we work, and there are now thousands of those people who are, you know, make a sustainable livelihood out of going in and working in a place-based way to reconnect the residents to their local cultures, their local economies, their local environments, the local possibilities. So it's really becoming, I think, a very, very powerful movement for change over the last, particularly the last 10 years.
Mm. I'd like to ask a question more about your background and how you became aware of this, maybe not problem, but this issue. And, you know, was there a state? And obviously, you know, with entrepreneurs, it's like, where did you get the idea from? How did you get it going? In this case, you're. It's not exactly a move. Perhaps it is a movement. I don't know, of community building. But when were you first aware of the problem, which your methodology or your framework was a problem, and how did you come to the process of coming up with this methodology? Like, perhaps you can describe some of your teen years or later on. When did it hit you that
I can pinpoint it for you. Yeah. So I trained in psychology, and I guess my focus, I thought, in my 20s when I was overqualified and fundamentally underexperienced, my focus was to work as a psychologist. That's what I thought I wanted to do with my life. And that's a very commendable profession and way to be in the world. So I don't in any way want to criticize it. But what I started, just by happenstance, what I started working in is in the field of residential childcare, and was part of a process and a time in the Irish context when we were transitioning for very, very big institutions where kids who were wards of court, in other words, had experienced a rupture with their families and their communities and were being sent into institutions, would have been sent to quite big religious institutions. I mean, a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with the scandals and, you know, some of the great dramatic stories, actually, that have emerged from those times. So I was on the cusp. I came in the sort of early 90s into transitioning from that way of caring, very much in inverted commas, to what we called community care. So this is where we would transition kids and young adults into neighborhood houses. So they, you know, come from very big gray walled buildings, often run by religious institutions. And we were transitioning them into smaller houses in the neighborhood. And it became very, very clear to me very quickly that while we badged that community care, there was neither community nor care in the fundamental sense of what we were doing. But all we were really doing was taking them from a big institution and putting them in a smaller institution because they weren't actually connected with the community. So while they were in the community, they were not of the community. And there was nothing in my training that gave me resource or tool to do anything with that. So I began having seen that, you know, there was a limit to this. And what the kids were asking for was some kind of a sense of connection, some kind of a sense. They'd lost connection with their families, with their own communities of origin often, albeit that there would be tenuous connections there. But they were looking to have a normal life, an everyday life. And part of that is being connected in the community. Many of the communities they were in were actually really frightened and hostile with the idea that an institution bought a house and landed in to their neighborhood.
Because so I guess the kids who were landed in were often quite troubled. So I can just imagine how in the UK context, a newspaper like the Daily Mail might, you know, these would be in the same category as asylum seekers, like negative social problem kids.
Yeah. So, you know, at any time the outsider comes in, right, the stranger from the edge comes in, depending on how much work you've done yourself or how psychologically threatened you feel, you see it as a danger, as the other. And we're seeing that play out, not just in the UK, but in a lot of countries, Brazil recently, the US. So, you know, everybody gets to play this particular othering game. But it was playing out very dominantly. And I think one of the things that really struck me was that the question we were trying to answer, we were answering within a very narrow therapeutic lens. You know, it says that these kids need some kind of therapeutic intervention. So we get psychologists, so we get youth workers, and they work with them. But each of us were trained in our own specialism. So we were working on a one-on-one basis. In other words, the assumption was that the problem was an individual problem. So if we could help this person get through their trauma, all would be well. What we didn't really understand, and what I came to understand, is actually it isn't just an individual change that's required. It actually requires some community development. In order for these kids to have a normal childhood, you need a village. You know, we all say, don't we? I think everybody would be familiar with the adage, it takes a village to raise a child. But hardly any of us actually do anything about it. So what I think I was identifying, and I think I was the oddball, in the band of people involved in this conversation at that stage, was we don't have a I suppose what you might call a youth problem or a child problem or a behavioral problem. We have a village problem, and we probably have two village problems: the village they came from and the village that they've landed in, and we need different tools to address that problem. So I started reaching out, first of all, within my fraternity. So, you know, you ask people like you, first of all, well, what do you think? Am I crazy? Does this seem to make sense to you? And, well, I was quite fortunate at the time that my boss said, well, why don't you have a look at, you know, promising practice out there when it comes? I think you're right, but we're not really sure what to do. Why don't you have a look at some examples? And that's where I encountered Professor John McKnight and the work that he was doing in Chicago in neighborhoods. And he was one of the few people, when I scanned the horizon line internationally for good practice, not best practice, by the way, because I think best practice is the enemy of better practice. So, but good practice and promising practice. He was one of the few people who was actually really addressing that question that I had, which is, how do I connect these kids with the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, the neighbor, so that they can have a normal life and not just connect them with yet another service and yet another program? Because that was one of the things that really struck me. It's nearly all of these kids that we were working with were surrounded by salaried strangers, but they had hardly anybody normal in their life who was just there because they loved them. Like if you went into a room with any of these kids, I could clear a room by saying, who here loves this child? If you don't leave, please, the child would be left on their own. Now, if that isn't a problem, I don't know what is. You know, we wonder why the hell, you know, these kids join gangs. I'll tell you why. Because we're not asking that question. Yeah. Exactly. So many of the really bum counterfeit kind of answers that we have at the moment to loneliness, to health issues, to obesity, like the answer is community, but we're coming up with counterfeit answers. And like, it's a multi-billion dollar industry. So I called out what I thought was a counterfeit response to what was really the core issue. John McKnight seemed to me to be a frontier person. So he, to my mind, was a real entrepreneur because, for my money at least, he, and I think this is a key entrepreneurial behavior, by the way. I think an entrepreneur challenges received wisdom.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
They say society has a kind of a general assumption that the problem can be fixed this way. Well, actually, I'm challenging that assumption, and here's the alternative. So I think what John said was, most people assume the reason that we have urban blight or even rural blight, why we have the fentanyl problem, why, you know, we have all of these issues in society, and loneliness, by the way, which goes right across the socioeconomic spectrum and will become one of the most predominant issues of our time. The reason we have that is not because of what generally is assumed, which is a failure of institutions. You know, the school fails, the hospital fails, the police fail, the social workers fail. It's not an institutional failure, but it's a community challenge. And I think he was one of the first people I heard say that. And that totally resonated for me as a kid who grew up in the west of Ireland. And I can relate to that. He's right. Just at a visceral level, I knew he was right. And I also knew it at a professional level because I had hit the limits of what I could do with my training. And the only thing that I think I did, which was commendable at that stage, was I listened and I learned, you know. And perhaps a second star on my copybook was that I guess I was humbled in a sense. I was willing to accept that all progress, I think the great entrepreneurs are the people who understand the limits of their system and try another way. So I became really, really curious about John and what he was doing and essentially apprenticed myself to him nearly 30 years ago. And that kind of brings us up to the current thing, like our journey's 30-year friendship. We've just co-authored a book called The Connected Community, which tells the stories of our journey across 36 countries and other people. But more importantly, it tells the stories of the communities themselves. And really, we're trying to use, you know, our privilege, our white middle class gendered privilege to say, hey, let's feature something that we think is largely invisible, which is these communities are doing really interesting and entrepreneurial and quite transformative stuff, but largely it's not featuring, it's not actually on our radars. So this book is about putting it on our radars.
That's very interesting. Well, thank you. And so what did, apart from sort of getting together with John McKnight, and obviously perhaps after this is over, I'll ask you to send a few links so we can put all this in the show notes so people can follow up if they're interested. But what did you do personally? Because, I mean, you said you became his disciple or got together with him, but what was your... And I think, you haven't described yourself as an entrepreneur, you were sort of identifying a problem which most people weren't even capable of verbalizing. So you'd seen from your own experience, seen the problem. And then what did you do, or together with him or by yourself? Well, how did you... So what was your next step?
So the next step for me was in 1996. So this is the entrepreneurial piece, I think. The next step for me was to say, I don't think that I can flourish within, I don't think I can practice this way of being in the world, this way of being helpful within the context of the health system. And so I think the next step was to say, I'm choosing not to try to reform the system. I'm leaving. And rather than just taking my ball and leaving the playground, I decided to leave with a view to creating a warmer space within which I could just grow that practice and learn. I was curious. I wanted to kind of, create a set of possibilities that really gave me a chance to play with some of this stuff. So I set up a social enterprise called Nurture Development in 1996. So the tagline that I gave that social enterprise was development redefined. So I wanted to think about a completely different way of thinking about development, which was development from inside out rather than top down and outside in. And I suppose, as you do when you set up a social enterprise, you start to build networks and build alliances and build opportunities and possibilities. And so I grew the business over time to be where it is today. And as a social enterprise today, we're present in, we have a footprint in 36 countries and provable evidential impact. I don't want to overclaim this, by the way, because it's people on the ground who are doing the work, not us. But we've had some consequential contributions in that regard. So I would say, while John was hugely important, I and my team have grown that space and grown the reputation around that work, and really taken an awful lot of what's broader than ABCD. So, more strength-based lenses and tools, for working with prisons and hospitals and things of that nature, so that we can now go in at every level of the system, from leadership to practice-based people, and give them some resources that will actually enable them to work this way.
Mm. Well, thank you for that. So you definitely meet our definition of an entrepreneur, because you took action. You didn't just think about it. And there are a lot of, I thought of you as more as a kind of academic thought leader, and that's just my ignorance. Perhaps I hadn't researched your resume well enough. So apologies for that.
Can I say something on that, Richard, because I think it may be useful. So one of the things, and I do think it's not, there may be a reason for that. And the reason is quite early on, I came to realize that actually what was coming into our wheelhouse was really important information that I couldn't hold on to myself in order to, make a living of it, that I felt it was so important and I felt so passionately about it. I just had to share it into the commons. But I also recognized that it is like a movement like this. Like the joke, you may have heard this one before, but the joke we'd often tell ourselves in the early days, when there was just a few of us trying to, open up the space for an asset-based community development way of working, is we'd say, there's definitely a gap in the market, but there isn't a market in the gap. And so we have to grow the market, because people don't know they need us. People don't really know they need this way of working. They think they've got it sorted. It's just, if they try harder and run faster and do more, it will eventually sort itself out. So I think a big part of what we did, particularly I did, was the blogging, the writing, what you guys are doing, the podcasting, the really saying, look, actually, a big part of what we have to do is we have to raise consciousness around this way of understanding things. And let those positive disruptors out there who want somebody like us to get alongside them and put some rocket fuel in their engine, know we're here, but also give them, even for free, I mean, particularly for free, actually, give them all kinds of entry points, including no cost at all, to say, we're part of a social movement here. And yeah, we have to make a sustainable livelihood, but this is bigger than us and it will go beyond us. So I think that's where the thought leadership piece probably came. So there was an element of recognizing that to do this work well, you've got to act like a social movement and a member of a social movement and be really generous while also behaving like an entrepreneur. And actually, it's the bite between those two things that gives real impact.
Mm.
So
I
do a lot of writing and, you know.
I'm trying to understand, but as I said, this is really fascinating and I totally agree. It all makes a lot of sense, as you said, from a gut perspective, it makes a lot of sense. But so you have all these institutions and I'm sure even today, you probably say that there's still plenty of top down, outside in, but they're getting money, right? I mean, they're getting financed by the government. They're getting financed by donations. They're getting financed somehow, and then they're deploying this money in the way that you're this non-optimal way that you're sort of describing. And so, what I'm trying to understand is, so with the Inside Out movement or the opposite way of doing it, the community-based movement, how do you? Because I think that's what's interesting. So like for me and for everybody who pays taxes and donates money into stuff is how do you actually get the money to the people and what do they do with it like differently?
Yeah. That's exactly the right question.
Yeah. Examples that you gave about the neighborhood connectors or whatever, they hired the community person then who's going to come in. And just to what extent is that person getting money, like trying to drum up financing, and then how are they deploying the money? How does it all work? I mean, like from that perspective.
Yeah. One of the things that taxpayers really need to understand, that this is why the left-right narrative is so bankrupt and so just mind-numbingly stupefying, is because it just totally misses the mark, you know, and misses a whole set of opportunities. So you take your average prison anywhere, Australia, the UK, whatever. And basically, the whole setup of the system is bonkers because it basically says our police officers, our retailers for the prison industry, which is privatizing, is going to turn poverty into money it has to be said, it's not the prison guards that are making the money. They often get paid less than people in McDonald's are getting paid. It's the private sector folks who run the prison. So if you look at, series a few years ago, Orange is the New Black, you know, just kind of, it talks a little bit about that. So basically, I think the unsuspecting public say, well, I pay my tax dollars and the bad guys get arrested and they go to prison. I mean, it's so inch deep in terms of analysis. And we're saying is this, look, actually, if you think about it, and this did happen in the 1970s in Massachusetts, you could be so much more radical and actually save so much more in your tax dollars if you actually got past thinking about the problem as being solved by services. So in the 1970s, there was an experiment in the US in Massachusetts called the Massachusetts Experiment, where a guy by the name of Jerry Miller shut down 11 reformatories and got about 1,000 to 1,044 kids out of prison and into community. And his great insight was to say that if I take the amount of money, tax dollars, that I currently spend or waste on each of these kids, incarcerating them, for that amount of money, face down, I could send them to Harvard, give them a very, very generous stipend per week, give them a place to live and pay for a cleaner. And still have change left over, right? So how anybody, left, right, or in between, thinks that it's really, really a good idea to take somebody and incarcerate them and spend that kind of money, and they can't come up with something else is kind of bonkers. So Jerry's great insight was to say, as the warden of wardens of these 11 prisons, I have convening power. So if I turn around and I say to communities, you know, like the faith communities, the, you know, the not-for-profits, the people in communities that you can get the attention of, right? Hey, folks, I'd like you, I'm going to come along on Thursday night. I'll meet you in the Presbyterian church because it's a good place and it's warm and they've agreed I can rent the room. And I'd like anybody who's interested in having a conversation with me as a warden of 11 prisons that is kind of currently babysitting, you know, thousands of your kids, to have a conversation with me around what a community alternative to incarceration would look like. Because I know many of you are angry with the way things are, and you talk about prison reform, but I'm here to tell you that we can reform our prisons up the gazoo. We can make them the best, the nicest, the safest prisons in the world. That's not the solution. Because 5 minutes after I release these kids from the wonderful prison, it's like a revolving door, they're back in again. The problem is further upstream. So I want to have a conversation with you about what's the community alternative to incarceration, and how could I channel some of the money that I'm currently, and remember, at the end of the day, what's a prison doing with money? It's procuring services. It doesn't have to be this way. It's a lack of entrepreneurship that says it's fixed, it's not fixed. The entrepreneur says it's not fixed, it's flexible. Let's try another way. He was an entrepreneur. He tried another way. So what he said, I think, was, I'm sick of trying to reform my system. He, a bit quasi-academic like myself, he was smart enough when he went in to try to do the reform of these 11 reformatories. And he was called in because the kids were being abused, right? So there was a hue and a cry and a scandal. But he just carried out a baseline. He said, you know, let's look at kind of what success looks like. And for him, it seemed obvious. Success is that if it's a prison, it reforms behavior. Therefore, these kids go out and they actually get on with life. And what he was finding was, no matter how much reform he did, somehow, for some reason, these kids were just on a pipeline right back in again. So what he said was, the issue is not reforming the prison service. The issue is, how do we get a community alternative to incarceration that actually enables these kids to share their skills and their talents and their abilities so they can actually get on with contributing to community? He successfully, and still to this day in Massachusetts, you can draw a straight line between that Massachusetts experiment. And that happened. He's not unusual. He didn't drop from Mars. Right. What was unusual were his practices, was his entrepreneurial bent. So here you have a bureaucrat, dare I say, if that sounds like a labeling term, I apologize to any of our listeners, but he was a bureaucrat, but he acted like an entrepreneur. So here you have somebody who's almost laundering money out of a system that is a very, very narrow view of what change needs to look like. And they're going further upstream and they're saying to the communities, hey, entrepreneurs, anybody with a bit of metal in their belly, stand up. You tell us what the alternative is. And if you want to do it, we'll resource you to do it. So we're not just gaslighting you and saying, come up with an alternative and we'll leave you.
So what actually happened? What did some of these, what were some of the ideas that people did?
There's some really wacky stuff. So, I mean, the most outrageous example, and he writes about this in his book, Last One Over the Wall, as in Last One Over the Wall, switch out the lights of the prisons. But the most wacky was in this era in the 70s, Pan Am Airlines were the first international airline to offer an around-the-world ticket. So you could buy a ticket for $3,000 and you could travel all around the world, 77 stops, and spend a year. So one of the things he funded, because he's saying, I have money, I will procure community alternatives, were a number of college students who said, hey, we've got an idea. We'd like to use our gap year to spend a year traveling the world with one of these prisoners. So you will release them into our care and together we'll travel around the world. Give us $3,000, give them $3,000 and give us $5,000 spending money and we'll send you a postcard from Seville. Of course, this was in the age when there was no, you know, email.
Sure.
This day, there are bureaucrats listening going, this is bonkers. This would never
I think the idea is
but
brilliant.
It was
personally, I think the idea is brilliant.
So do I. And here's the thing, right? Here's the thing. So this guy, quite rightly, is saying, hey, this is chip money. I mean, like, by comparison with what I spend to incarcerate people, You know, obviously I'm going to filter out. So I'm going to try and set myself up for success here and release some kids who, you know,
the best,
you know. Look, what happens? What happens is this. The kid's life has changed forever. The student's life has changed forever. Their families get to know each other. They go and they learn things. You know, they come back to the United States enlightened. They know where different parts of the world are, you know, and so on and so forth. And in all kinds of ways, the trajectory of these kids has changed irrevocably forever, and they're forgotten to the system, right? Their record is expunged, and many of them now are off living their life, being entrepreneurs, doing whatever, probably helping other kids, right? Because they know how close they came and what a lucky escape they had. So in a sense, you know, this thing of community, it doesn't just happen. It often needs people to precipitate. And that's what Jerry was doing. He was acting as a kind of a, like almost that food that gets into the oyster that kind of creates the pearl, right? An irritant. It's like, come on, you're saying we're the best alternative? Well, you step up. What would you do? And then he was resourcing them. Some of the other stuff was just like, you know, saying, this guy, he's really good at fixing bikes. And what we'll do is we will create space in, you know, the basement of our local community center for this kid to set up. We'll get a few local people to mentor him who, you know a little bit about how to run a business. And we'll support this kid to create a valued social role. So we will literally perform social alchemy. So this kid who has a reputation is now the kid who repairs secondhand bikes in the neighborhood to as good as new and brings real value to low-income families who can't afford to buy a new bike. You know, so they're just some examples.
So Cormac, I'm conscious of time, and, you know, I'm sure many of our listeners will be really struck by these examples, because these are ideas that they might not have heard elsewhere. And I got interested in community projects, and when running my TEDx, I had various community builders, including people you've heard of, particularly our common friend Mark McCurgow, on the stage talking about their different community projects. But I found it very difficult to find how to find these community connectors. You talked about people going into a community and identifying them. And could you share what, you know, and are there magazines they read or things? How do you identify the community connectors? Question number one. And secondly, where would you go if you wanted to say, Cormac's sparked my interest in this whole area, but I want to find out more. Where could someone find, like, the encyclopedia of great community ideas? Obviously not on the assumption that, you know, you can insert one idea of Massachusetts into Belgium and it's going to work. But just where can people go if they want to identify the people and identify the ideas?
Yeah. So the first question first, how do you discover connectors? I think one of the things that's really important to be aware of, and I, you know, talk a lot about this in the new book, which is the answer to the second question to an extent. One of the things that's really striking to me is that connectors are born, not made or trained. So they're there already. So your question is an excellent question, Richard, because it is about discovering them. Mm-hmm. Rather than training people. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the way you frame the question is excellent. And that's really important, because otherwise we could end up going down a rabbit hole. So they're there. So then the question is, how do we find them? Well, the first thing, and we talk a lot about this in the book, the first thing is to recognize that connectors by nature are relational, right? So that means that they are likely to be in relationship, to be in association. So one of the first things I would say is go to the bumping places and the gathering spaces in the neighborhood and pay attention to who the hosts are, who's convening, right? And then watch for their behavior. What's their motivation in convening? Are they convening to get a followership, or are they convening because they really enjoy the idea of actually supporting people to be in connection and in exchange with each other? If it's the second, you've found a connector. The second thing to do is to recognize it takes one to find one. So once you've found one, you would say to them, hey, I really appreciate the way you did this, 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 because they may not be consciously aware of the virtuous nature of their behavior. And then I would say, do you know anybody else like you? that's kind of really good at gathering people up or whatever. The third thing, and this is current, one of my shorthand tricks is I would say, hey, you know, back in 2020 and 2021, when we had lockdown, can you remember who the people in the neighborhood were who were holding this community together and connecting, whether it was on land or online? Who were they? And could you introduce me to them? And I would use a snowball methodology. I'd go and I'd have conversations. It takes all but 5 minutes to kind of find out whether somebody is kind of gift oriented, you know, and strengths-based, whether they're glass half full or glass half empty. So I'm very, very interested in finding the folks. This is the fourth and final thing I'd say, who've got convening power. So it's very interesting. You find this in organizations too. You know, it's not the shop steward that can necessarily get everybody out. It's often if you look at, you know, what's happening in the organization, you really want to pay attention to who is not so much the leader, but who's the person that people will follow, you know, but in a sense of in a trustful way. And so the fourth piece is, can they actually, do they know, for example, 10 other people that if they were to say to them, hey, I really think we should go to this party, or hey, I really think we should think about this or have this conversation, that those people would come. You know, one of the things, Richard, that's very striking to me about connectors is you'd never find any self-respecting connector handing out leaflets or doing flyer drops in the neighborhood. For them, it's all in person. It's all word of mouth. And that ripple effect, they have built a lot of confidence around. Interestingly, though, this is almost universal. When I, you know, express some gratitude or appreciation to a connector, I said, gee, it's amazing how you connected those kids who were getting in trouble with Mrs. Miggins and helped her kind of get her garden back in check again. That was really amazing. Nearly all of them will say that that's just what you do. That's just being neighborly. So most of them do not have any self-awareness. It's not like I'm an entrepreneur or I'm a leader. Yes, because society doesn't value the connector. So one of the reasons they're really hard to find is because, like, I do this exercise in training. I'd say, okay, you know, 20 people, give me an example from popular culture of a connector. I've given you a definition. You know, is there a movie you've seen? Is there a character? And they really, really struggle because there's no Hollywood version of the connector, really. So in that sense, I think it is hard. I recognize that. And you do need. So to your second question, that's why we wrote this most recent book, John McKnight and I. We wanted to give the connectors and people who are working as paid community workers a compass. You can't give them a map, as you said, but we wanted to give them a compass, a set of principles that they could work to. And so we've kind of, this is, I think, our most clear explication of how to do this work in really granular, practical ways that anybody could pick up. And it's written for doers. It's written for people who just say, I want to get on and do something here. It takes them through a really simple process, discover, connect, and mobilize. That's the three sections of the book. And we take people through, first of all, how to discover the strengths, the functions, the assets, the connectors in the neighborhood, then how to connect them, and then how to mobilize to greater action and possibility.
Mm. Fantastic. Well, we're coming up to the end of our allotted time. And I think for many of our listeners, this is a very different way of looking at reality and society, and extremely interesting and valuable. And certainly in our understanding of entrepreneurship, whether they're connectors, they're simply people who are changing the world, seeing problems and doing things, whether they're conscious of it or not. So, yeah, and certainly there's more than one leadership style, as we all know. And so in some ways, there's a perfect match, even for not all leadership styles. So just before we wrap, are there any things that we haven't had time to cover that you think are important for our audience here, like any closing thoughts or things we didn't just ask you, to a conclusion? Yeah.
Just really quickly, this is our 30th anniversary, but it's also the anniversary of another very significant movement, which was started by a guy called E.F. Schumacher. It's the 50th anniversary of a book that some of your listeners will know of, published in 1973, called Small is Beautiful. And I just want to say that another, it's implicit in what we've been talking about, but just the virtue of small things, the virtue of local things, and that it's okay to start close in and to start small and start local. And my favorite example of this is a UK entrepreneur, Bayliss, who invented the wind-up radio in 1991, listening to a BBC program about the issue of AIDS and HIV and malaria and other such issues in Africa. And what he recognized was that the issue is that people don't have plug-in radios, right? So getting information about sexual health and opportunities just wasn't available to them. So he did something which is kind of counterintuitive. He invented something that seemed quite retro and quite basic, which was the wind-up radio, but it perfectly fit the local context. And E.F. Schumacher, The Small is Beautiful theory, is all about appropriate technology. What's right for this place and this place alone? And I think we're moving into a time, given all of the various challenges, where giantism and big solutions and going to scale and taking over the world and globalization are probably pretty bankrupt. And I think it is a time when opportunities are going to be hyper-local. So I'm very excited about those opportunities. In a world full of crisis, there's a lot of opportunity to go more local and to try to take those small solutions forward. But I'd perhaps suggest on finishing that way.
Fantastic.
I want just final, I find this to be very motivating. And I think a lot of people who are listening probably feel the same way. And so, but what does a guy like me, I want to give money or time. What can we do? Like, what can the listener do actually? You know, a lot of these are frameworks and like for the people are frameworks for organizations. And how can you make a difference? How can the single individual make a difference here? Well, because we talked about just donating the money to the wrong top-down organizations. Yeah. So what do we do with our money and our time?
It's a great question. I mean, one of the things that's, and I'm not peddling the book or anything, but it struck me. I just come off a call with Greenwood Coalition, which is a coalition of community people out in Port Hope in Ontario. And their local residents have each bought a copy of the book, are actually forming a reader circle, you know, so a book club, but they're actually systematically over the next 4 months going to implement all of the ideas in the book until they organize their entire community. That includes local businesses. You know, so that's one piece. Another is, you know, this is at scale, but like if I look at what's happening with Nebraska and the Nebraska Community Foundation, there's an example, I think, that's a beautiful example of where communities are asking the question you asked. So we have small towns that are struggling, that their biggest export is their young people. And what they're beginning to realize is we got to put our money into our town, not just our kids, because we're capitalizing our kids to go to college out of state, to buy homes out of state, and to set businesses up out of state. Well, if you got three kids, you got a fourth one now. It's called your town. And if you don't put your dollars into that, then it's going to die because the kids are gone and you're gone and that's that. So what they're doing is they're creating local enterprises, local employment schemes. We can do things as well with, like, for example, having EV fleets of cars in our local neighborhoods. So instead of everybody having their own car as a household, why not say, hey, actually, let's pool our money in a different way. The biggest, fastest growing social movement in Australia is the Bendigo Bank Community Bank Movement. This is where communities are creating their own community banks, taking tax dollars that were going out of state into faceless multinationals and bringing it back home. So these are things that we could do to make our money circulate more around our economy.
Awesome.
But hey, you could also just say hello to a neighbor that you tend to avoid.
Yep. Yeah, start with your own neighborhood.
Exactly.
Anyway, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
It's been really interesting.
Well, thank you so much for hosting
the time.
Indeed.
It's a pleasure.